Okay. All right. Well, welcome to everybody. This is Jazz on the Tube, and we're here talking with Charlie Ellerbe. This is part of our Remembering Ornette series. And why are we doing this? Well, Ornette was an amazing human being, an amazing musician, and not everybody had the opportunity to know him or talk with him or work with him. And we'd like to share what that experience was like. So one of the first people I thought of was Charlie. I was at the memorial event in New York City, and for the recessional, Primetime played, which was just marvelous to hear and to see everybody. And I talked with Charlie very briefly after that and asked if he'd be willing to do a call like this, and he said yes. So welcome, Charlie.
Thank you so much, man.
And Charlie, you are, and I want to talk about this because Ornette found a lot of the musicians that he worked with in Primetime in Philadelphia. And just, first, I'd like to talk about your experience as a young guy growing up in Philadelphia, discovering music, learning music, embracing music. And then we'll talk about how Ornette found you and what it was like working with him at such a young age.
Young age, huh? I was always interested in like music as a collective. I was never interested in no one instrument, you know. I mean, not guitar, piano, trumpet, saxophone. I wasn't really impressed with what a single instrument did. You know, I was more or less like not into symphony music, but it takes a whole orchestra to sound, you know, the way that sounds, you know, the way that an orchestra sounds. And that's what I like, the collective sound. It's a big sound. One instrument is just one instrument, you know. So I took me many years to pick an instrument because I liked music so well and I wanted to be a part of music. I couldn't sing, so if you can't sing, you have to have an instrument, and that's the thing. I was not interested in any instrument. I was, you know, in other words, I wanted to be able to play something that sounded like the whole band at one time, the bass, the drums, the guitar, the horns, you know, because that was music to me, not one instrument. One instrument is like, it's like having a car, and all you have is one piece of the car, you know. It's like, no, I want the whole car. It's like, well, you know, you got to buy the whole car, you know. But in the case of music, you can't be a one-man show and play all those instruments at one time, you know, and sound like that. So many more years went by, you know, and I still, you know, was not interested in not one instrument at all. Until I seen a good friend of mine in junior high school. I didn't even know he played guitar at all, and we were best of friends. His name was Arnold Langley, and we were best of friends. He was in the junior class, I was in the senior class, and the junior class decided to put on a show for the senior class because we were graduating. And that's when I saw Arnold come on stage with a guitar and amp, and I thought he was bringing it out for the guitar player, not knowing that he was the guitar player. He was 14, I was 15, and we're talking like 1965, you know, so I hadn't heard of Jimi Hendrix. So when I make this comparison, it's not like I knew about Jimi Hendrix then, but a few years later, when I did find out about Jimi Hendrix, I was able to make this comparison. But at the age of 14, Arnold played like Jimi Hendrix, and this is like pre-wah-wah pedal because they weren't invented yet, pre-distortion box because they weren't invented yet, so Arnold was just a natural. You know, and like I said, I had never heard of Jimi Hendrix. He wasn't out yet, you know, or came to the attention of the general public yet. And Arnold just blew my mind. It's not the fact he played guitar. It's like what he did on it. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do that, what he did on it. I didn't want to play guitar. I wanted to do what he did on the guitar. So it's like in order to do that, I had to get a guitar. You know, and I only got a guitar because I wanted to be able to do what Arnold, I was impressed with what I saw Arnold. So that started me down the road of playing guitar, but I still was complaining a lot about that collective music sound. And I didn't know it was called an arranger. You know, he's the guy in charge of that collective sound. I actually thought that bands and orchestras sounded the way that they sound because of each person created their own part. And somebody says, no. They just carry out the orders of the guy who gives out the musical orders. I was like, well, who's that? I said, the arranger or the composer is the one that wrote all of that stuff for the reason why that band sounds the way it sounds. It's like, that's not the band? They didn't do that? It's like, mm-mm. Composer did that. He's in charge of the collective sound. He comes up with that sound that you hear, Charlie. So, at that point when I got a little older and I graduated high school, I went to college for music and I studied composition and arranging, not guitar. That's the last thing I even want to be as a guitar player. I don't want to be a guitar player, you know, and I don't consider myself one at all. Mm. You know, guitar players are people like Les Montgomery, George Benson, Earl Klugh, Charles Christian, like, Kenny Burrell, you know, Philip Upchurch, you know, these are people that are guitar players, and just so happens Philip Upchurch and Kenny Burrell are two of my favorites, you know, and they didn't get a lot of notoriety, you know, and I forget exactly how I found them because they came out around the same time as George Benson. It was George Benson, Philip Upchurch, and Kenny Burrell. And George Benson somehow or another got the leading spot in the public, you know. But I was really a fan of Kenny Burrell, you know, and Philip Upchurch, and I love them to death. I never met them, but doesn't matter. You know, I still love them to death, right? So, I went to college for composition and arranging. And like I said, I never considered myself a guitar. I really used the instrument. And that's probably why I got the job with Ornette. You know, it really wasn't an audition, really. And probably the reason why I got the job with Ornette, because I used the guitar for total self-expression. You know, my total musical expression, not to play the guitar, just expressing myself. You know, it's like you can express yourself a few different ways, you know, by your mouth. You know, people do it all the time. That's how they express themselves, you know. And in this case, when I'm not expressing myself with my mouth, you know, I do that with my guitar. So I'm not trying to play guitar, you know. I'm just trying to play music off of that instrument and not guitar off of guitar, mm-hmm. if that makes any sense to you.
Absolutely. And Ornette, it reminds me of how Ornette used to talk about music. He wasn't interested in what the instrument did. He was interested in what the person was trying to do.
Exactly.
With the instrument. The instrument was secondary. It's just, you know, you needed something. Just like you said, you couldn't sing, so you played an instrument.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that's the reason why he got me, because I was more or less, you know, like I said, using the instrument for self-expression as opposed to play, and I don't mean no offense to anybody else out there, but play, you know, the guitar mechanically, you know, like it's a device, you know, and some people use devices mechanically, and some people use devices like it is an extension, you know, of their body. You know, it's like some race car drivers. It's like they drive so well, they tell you, it's like, I drive that well because I'm not feeling the car. It's like an extension of my body, you know. And so it's kind of, for lack of a better way to explain it, I guess that's the closest I can get, you know, right now to expressing, you know, this. So, yeah, I used the guitar for, like, total self-expression once I learned how to play the guitar. Of course, I had to go through the mechanics in the beginning to, you know, like, you know, when you drive a car, you got to go through the mechanics, you know. But after you go through the mechanics, you don't drive like you're still going through the mechanics. You drive like, you know, like a pro. I mean, you still don't tie your shoes the same slow way, like over, around, under, and through. You know, you just like zip, 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 done.
Right.
And somebody said, wow, you do that like a professional. It's like, what, tie my shoes? I've been doing it for 55 years, you know.
Okay. So you got this exposure to the guitar in high school, and then this discovery that, oh, it's about the composer and the arranger, and that brought you to college where you studied composing.
Composition and arranging.
Was all this in Philadelphia area?
Yeah, I went to It was a non-accredited college, but it was very, it had like a very, very home atmosphere. It was called Combs College of Music. It had a very, very home atmosphere, and that's what made it work, you know, because in a large college, you know, you really cannot, you know, like get to your instructor like sometimes on a one-on-one basis. So our classrooms were like very small. You know, and the instructors and the students were almost like one. You know, like we could walk up to the instructor as we walk down the halls, you know, to our small college, and we could stop the instructor and ask him questions and, you know, just have conversation about, you know, whatever said topic that they were, you know, teaching. You know, and so, yeah, and the students, you know, we knew each other because it was a small college, you know, and it was very atmospheric because you can hear echoing through the hall bits of classical music from a student in the closed practice room, you know, like practicing his recital. You can hear echoes of vocalists who study opera. You can hear echoes, you know, of, you know, like from the drum class. So, you know, it's like walking through the halls, you hear faint echoes of everything that's going on. So it was really, you know, really a nice environment, you know. So I'm just saying later for the fact it wasn't accredited because I wasn't really going after credits. I was going after the subject, you know, and the material that I needed to learn. You know, I wasn't credits is if you were going to teach in the public school system. I didn't want to teach, so that's why I didn't care about going to a non-accredited college.
Gotcha. And so you got the purpose of education, which was to learn.
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I had a very good composition teacher, but that's another story, you know, but he was very good. Dr. Castellino, you know, I'll never forget him.
Well, Philadelphia has a really rich, deep musical culture. It may not be on the people's radar the way New York and Chicago and New Orleans are, but I mean, there's so many people there. It's still the fifth biggest city in the States. A lot of talent, a lot of music, and you there's some of the guys from Primetime also came from Philadelphia. Is that right?
Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
So it was you and Jamal. He lived in Philly too. Jamal did too.
First, you know, me and Jamal, we were playing for Charles Erwin, you know, the organist. And I don't know how to put it. I don't really want you to print it the way I'm saying it, so if you can sugarcoat it, right. But for whatever reason, I was the first one to be dismissed or leave the situation with Charles Erwin, and Jamal stayed another year. And Jamal called me on the phone, and as we talked, you know, I asked him, you know, I said, "Oh, so are you home, man? I was going to stop over his house." He says, "No, I'm still in New York." He says, he was beating around the bush because he wanted me to come up to New York because Ernest needed a guitar player, but I was still thinking that Jamal was playing with Charles Erwin. And I asked him, I said, "Oh, he's still in New York, but so how are things with Charles Erwin?" He says, "Oh, I don't play with him anymore." I was like, "Wow, you don't?" But making a long story short, he says, "I'm playing with this other guy now named Ornette Coleman. I just happened to have one of Ornette's albums, you know, that I never listened to. I just had it in a collection of jazz albums. I just never got around to listening to it."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Yeah, man, I'm playing with this guy named Ornette Coleman, saxophone player." I says, "Oh, yeah, I kind of heard of him. I know a little bit, you know, I've heard of him, right?" So he says, "Yeah, he's looking for a guitar player, you know." So it's kind of exactly what it was. Ornette asked Jamal, "Are there any more at home like you in the form of a guitar player?" And Jamal said, "Yeah, Charlie." You know, so called me up there. And at first I wasn't going to go because I kind of like started off, you know, in the world of guitar and, you know, hard rock. At that time, that's what it was called because it was like first generation. So it was called hard rock. It was always featuring my instrument, you know. And before hard rock, there was no hard rock. It was just like R&B music.
Right.
You know, and jazz, you know. You know, and I'm saying this with no disrespect. It's like at that time, the white boys had not come out with hard rock yet, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They were just like the Everly Brothers back then, you know. And, you know, I think it was Ricky Nelson or, you know, it was that sort of thing, you know, going on back then. It wasn't too much guitars jumping out there, you know, being the lead. And it just so happened I just came along when the birth of that, you know, hard rock, it came out. So my guitar was being, I mean, my guitar, the instrument I played, was being featured, you know, all of a sudden, all over everywhere. So quite naturally, it caught my attention, and I wanted to do what these guitar players were doing, you know, because they were getting a more prominent spot in things now, and you know, guitar players were being noticed, you know, as opposed to just being in the background, shanking on some chords and rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I identified with that. And when Jamal said Ornette, I was like, I just thought he was this jazz cat who played all this jazz stuff. And I knew that jazz was more of an acoustic sound than music than electric. And most jazz musicians, because of that acoustic sound, they had sensitive ears. And I, you know, I didn't want to turn down. Not like I played annoyingly loud. But, you know, with hard rock, you have to have a certain amount of presence coming from your instrument, you know.
Yep.
And, you know, which involves a certain amount of volume. And, you know, hard rock is called hard rock.
Right.
Hard hitting, you know.
Right.
You hit hard. You ain't hitting soft like Night Tunisia, you know, like, or Misty.
Right,
you know?
Right.
You're hitting hard, you know. So I didn't want to annoy anybody who was an acoustic, you know, like a musician with the sounds of electronics and the decibels that it takes to have you know, your notes sustain, not feedback. You know, guitar players could never sustain notes. You know, now when it became hard rock, we, you know, they had distortion box, and we can sustain a note like a saxophone player.
Right.
We couldn't do that before,
right.
You know. So it opened up another world where we can kind of start embarking on some of the things that other instruments could do that we couldn't. You know, so I told Jamal, I said, no, I'm not going to go. And then I was glancing at his album cover while I was talking to Jamal on the phone about this. I said, no, I'm not going to go. And then my mind came to me and said, look, go. You're not going to get the gig because he's jazz and you're hard rock, but it would look good on your resume. They don't audition with Ornette Coleman. Whoever saw that wouldn't know why you didn't get it. They would go, well, wow, you must be good if you know, you got called to make an audition, even though you didn't get it, but you must be good. So I said, well, it would look good to pad my resume with that.
Okay.
So I said, okay, I'm going to come, and I really expected him to, like, send me home within 15 minutes, but I didn't care. It's like, hey, I don't have to put that in my resume. I could just put down made audition for Ornette Coleman. You know, so when I left my house, I was getting ready to leave, and I was taking my wah-wah pedal and none of my hard rock gimmicks, and then something said, well, you're not going to get the gig, so why are you going up there without your stuff? Carry your stuff anyway. So I did, you know, and when I got there, you know, we greeted each other, and I took out my instrument. He gave me some music, and Bern Nix and Jamal and Ronald Shannon Jackson was already there. And of course Jamal, you know, and they gave me some music, and as soon as I got settled, he counted off, and they started playing, you know, and he went over this song about like four times, you know, which isn't unusual for any musician. You know, I do it in my band all the time. Yeah, let's go over it again, and you know, do this part or straighten this part out. So after four times of, you know, like going over the same song, he looks at me and says, man, turn up, I can't hear you. I was like, OMG. It's like, okay. You can't hear me? I'm going to let you hear me now. You're going to run me out of here, right?
Wow.
Now, this was like around, by the time I left Philly and got there, it was like about 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
Dude is 9 o'clock at night, and he ain't ran me out yet. And, you know, my amp is about 7.5 on volume.
Wow.
You know, and I got my distortion box on, you know, so that even adds more of a little edge on the volume. So we're talking almost like 8.5, right? And it's 9 o'clock at night now, and Ornette is like, okay, we're going to try this song. I was like, oh, wait a minute, man. It's like 9 o'clock at night. I was in Philly. I had to go back home. So obviously, I got the gig. So it wasn't really an audition, you know. He was like, just the fact that I appeared to be functionable, you know, with the music was good enough for him. Like, so, okay, he's functionable. In a matter of time, he'll get better. But at least he's functionable. He's not, like, totally, like, lost in the sauce, in the mud, don't know what to do, you know. And it was really different, you know, like... I didn't know his music or the structure of it that well. He writes a melody, and after the melody, these guys are, like, playing, you know, like, for another, like, 8 minutes. And I'm like, well, where's the rest of the music on the page? Where are you guys playing from? It's like, we're playing from a concept that Ornette taught us called harmonic, and we're also playing from our intellect, you know, of using that concept. Like, if somebody shows you the concept of how to use a ruler, then you use your intellect, you measure all sorts of things, you know? Mm. I mean, a ruler hasn't built anything yet, but look at what a ruler has helped, you know, like to build, you know? Mm. Houses, you know, you know, all sorts of, you know, like different geometrical things, but yet a ruler hasn't built anything yet. You know, so it was like that. These guys were playing from a concept called harmonics and as much intellect as you can put behind, you know, like what you learn. Just like when you go to college, you know, you learn a course. So that's the concept. And you put your own intellect behind the course that you learn. You know, that's what sets you different, you know, from other dentists who went to the same dental school as you do, as you did. You know, so I was like, oh, so there is no more music on the page, you know. So I was just functionable, like I said. And earlier I did say, you know, I play the guitar for total self-expression. And that was another thing that probably got to Ornette, because I wasn't trying to play the guitar. I was, you know, self-expressing myself, and I was trying to play music off the instrument and not guitar on guitar, you know. So, and that was good enough for him. He was, you know, when I really look back on it, it looked like he really didn't have time to audition anybody. The person that came in and did what I said in the beginning, if they showed that they are functional, you know, and that they were trying to express themselves on the instrument as opposed to play the instrument, it was like, okay, yeah, that's good enough for me. I can move on. I got other business, you know, a lot more important business to do. Now I can move, as opposed to screening, you know, and auditioning guitar players.
Gotcha.
Right? So, like I said, after that, it was like 14 years of him being a friend, him being an educator, him being a musician to me, you know, and the love he had, you know, like for us as human beings, you know. So it was, to say, a great experience is almost like insulting the entire situation, you know. It was more than that. I mean, put it this way. No astronaut that's ever been on any of the space shuttle missions, you know, has anything of when it comes to experience on me. You know, I've experienced the same thing musically playing with Ornette as they have experienced seeing the Earth from the other side. You know, well, I've seen music from the other side playing with Ornette, which very few people has done. Just like astronauts, very few people has seen what they've seen. So it's like my life has been just as exciting as theirs, because musically, darn near seen half the galaxy, just like Captain Picard, you know, musically, you know. And because he showed me how to do that, I can continue to travel out there where no other man has gone before and probably will go eventually, you know. But he showed me harmonics, you know, that will carry me. The galaxy is endless and infinite. You'll never get to the end of it if you go, you know, like in any direction. You'll never get to the end of it. And the same way, you know, when he opened up harmonics, I'll never get to the end of it. Nobody ever will, you know. So that's the best thing about it. It's like he left me with a gift that will keep on giving, and even after I'm dead. And the only reason why I just stopped in is because I'm dead and I can't manipulate it anymore, you know, but somebody else will. You know, Arnett will continue to live through any of us that is perpetuating that concept called homiletics. He started it. He was the, you know, like a mother and father, you know, like of it. And, he gave birth to it, you know, and, you know, like he shared it and instilled it, you know, like, and nurtured it, you know, in us. And, you know, like I said, that's what I see is his legacy that he left behind. And as long as there's us humans here, that, and there's a lot of us, I was surprised that it's human to find out so many people came up to me that I never knew. I mean, that I knew from being in New York with Ornette, but I never knew they crossed the homiletic path with Ornette, you know. So there's a lot of people that has been affected by this movement called homiletics, you know. Despite the masses of people, but I haven't heard of that. What is that? It's like, it sounds crazy. It's like, yeah, you can say all of that, but if you see the amount of people that's been affected by that, you would change your mind. It's like, oh, wow, it's cool. It's enough of us to start, you know, like a more than a compound. You know, I mean, it's like, it's enough of us to start, you know, like a culture. You know, it's like enough people give us our own state. You know, it's enough of us, you know, like to be a city. Yeah. You know, I mean, if you gather everybody or just put it out there, all those people affected by homiletics, because all the people that I know that are the people that I know, but there's hundreds more beyond that that I don't know. You know, that Ornette, I mean, like the musicians, the Juju, Morocco musicians, you know, I don't know them, but Ornette did, you know, people like that. So I'm sure it's a lot of us, enough to populate a city.
Well, he was a tireless teacher, and anybody who showed interest, you know, he had no sense of rank. You know, he wouldn't say, well, you're not a famous musician, so I don't have any time for you. He tried to teach me harmonics. I still have a piece of paper with
him. That's exactly my point. So good. So you're another one. You would be in that city with us, you know?
Can I test an understanding with you? I found some video of Jamal. Haven't spoken with him yet directly, but I found some video where he's explaining harmonics and the music, and I experienced it when I was again at the memorial. You guys played for the recessional, and of course Ornette's not there. He's not playing, and yet. And let me go back. What Jamal said was, look, it looks like there's a front man and all these side men, but that's not the nature of this music. It's just, you know, everybody has to, you know, Ornette's got to stand somewhere, I've got to stand somewhere, and there's a certain showbiz sort of protocol, so you do that. But that's not what it's about. And when you guys played at the memorial, I realized, yeah, this music, this way of music has nothing to do with a front man, a leader, a side man, backup player. It's a different concept entirely.
I have to stop you, Ken. Keep your train of thought, but I have to stop you and say this. What Ornette told us at a rehearsal one time when we took a break, this is what Ornette said. The quickest way to get fired from my band is any of y'all try to background me like I'm just using this as an example. He wasn't downgrading any musician. He says, the quickest way to get fired in my band, if any one of y'all background me like I'm this front man like Kenny G and y'all is my background band. He says, I don't want that. He says, I want all you guys on the front line musically. He says, you don't have to stand abreast with me, you know. He says, but musically, he says, I want all y'all on the front line. His exact words, I want y'all to kick my ass.
Wow.
Give me a run. He says, because if you do that, he says, if you background me, I won't have a challenge, you know. But if you guys, you know, not compete with me, but play just like we all, you know, is the leader of the band, you know, and you don't have to play second fiddle, you know. He says, y'all guys are going to play stuff that I would never begin to think of, and that would make me play different and go places I would never, ever think to go if y'all, you know, have this freedom to go where you want to go. He says, because I might be wanting to go somewhere, but when I start to go there, one of y'all may beat me to it. So I'm going to have to change and go somewhere else. But if you background me, he says that will never happen. Mm. He says, now, only background me if you can't, if that's the only thing you can figure out to do. You can't think of nothing else to do. And as opposed to shut up and don't play anything at all, and if you think the best thing you can be doing at that time is backgrounding me, he says, then I'll accept that. But don't think that that's your job.
Hmm. Wow.
I was like, okay. So that's probably what Jamal meant when he says, yeah, it looks like there is a leader and background guys, but really it isn't. Somebody's got to stand out front, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's why I had to... you know, like, bring that part to your attention.
Oh, I'm really glad you did. There's so many things we could talk about. We may have hit the most important things, and may not even need to say any more than that, because that's a lot. But what I would like to talk about, of course, you had a long career with him. Do you remember the year that you started, that you first auditioned, and when all that?
Yeah.
Okay.
It was like, wait a minute. Well, I said, yeah, no, it was something slipped right out of my mind. I think it was September. Yeah, it was September. Late September, but it was still warm. Or mid-September. Right? Maybe it was like early September. But anyway, it was September because one of the things he said was he had... And he sounded like he really didn't want to go, you know. But he said, yeah, man, I made a commitment to do a performance in France in the month of October. And that's what it was all about. He had one gig to do in France, and that's why he needed a guitar player. It wasn't like, I need a guitar player because I'm going on tour, you know, and this and that. He had a gig to do, and, you know, he needed a guitar player. Actually, Reggie Lucas was there. I don't know if you know Reggie Lucas,
sure.
But Reggie Lucas, yeah, he was there. And Jamal ran into Reggie Lucas. And when Jamal got fired from Charlie Erlin's band, Jamal didn't come back home. He stayed in New York and pounded the pavement and ran into Reggie Lucas. And Reggie Lucas told him that Ornette was looking for a bass player, so that's how Jamal got that.
Oh.
Then a few days later, or maybe a week or two later, Reggie heard that Miles Davis was looking for a guitar player because Miles was getting ready to go to Japan. So Reggie left Ornette to go with Miles, and that's when Ornette did what I told you. It's like, Jamal is there anymore at home, like you in the form of a guitar player, you know, and, you know, that's how that went, you know, like as far as Jamal, you know, like getting the gig with Ornette. And so, yeah, Ornette said to me, it's like, yeah, man, I made a commitment to do a performance in France in October, you know, so... When he asked me, he's like, yeah, man, can you come back tomorrow so we can finish rehearsing? I was like, oh, wow, that must mean I got the gig, you know? So I called Ornette to let him know, you know, because I wasn't expecting to get the gig, Ken.
Right.
I went up there purposely, and I played in a way because I wanted him to say, get out, you know, one-note solo playing hard rock guitar player. This is jazz. You know, we ain't, you know.
Right.
He never did that. So I called him. I was like, this guy must be out of his mind, you know, and sooner or later he's going to be calling these jazz standards, and I don't know any of them. You know, and I ain't that. So I called him over. I said, Ornette. He says, yeah. I said, man, I don't play any jazz. So he said, okay. And he walked away. And I was like, no. He walked away too fast. He didn't let that settle in. And, you know, sooner or later, he's going to say, call the jazz standard and say, well, all guitar players know that. And like, I have to, you know, like reiterate, I'm not a guitar player. You know,
right.
I ain't into that.
Right.
So I called him back again and I said, Ornette, I don't know any standard jazz songs. So he's like, okay. And he walked away again. I was like, no. See, he's taking this too much for granted. I know we're going to get out there on that stage, and he's like, man, we're going to warm up first, and we're going to play Misty, and I'm going to punch him in the face. I'm being open with you. That's exactly what I had on my mind. It's like, I'm trying to tell this man, right. I'm in the hard rock. I don't do this other stuff.
Right.
You know, I'm not against it, but that ain't what I'm about.
Right.
You know, and I want him to know that because I don't want him to be disappointed when we get out there and talk about all guitar players know a little bit. I'm not a guitar player.
Right.
You know?
I
called him back for a third time and I said, Ornette, I play hard rock. That's what I do. Well, very frustratedly, he put both his hands in the air and he looked at me and he said, "Well, play that then!" And he walked off. And I told myself, I was like, okay, I'm satisfied. He can't say I didn't warn him. He can't say I didn't tell him. And I made sure I got his attention to annoyance, you know, that he knows that I don't do that. So it's like, I am prepared. If he get me out there and call a jazz song, I'm going to push him off the stage. I'm not lying.
Okay. So, and by the way, can I just interject something? Ornette was known for his great patience. He was maybe the most patient person I ever met.
Oh, please. Yes, sir.
However, he could get annoyed with you.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
So, let me just put the cap on this.
Yeah.
So, I'm saying, man, when we get out there, I just knew he was going to call these standards. God bless him, Ornette is dead and gone now. I'm still waiting for him to call the standards. He never did. You know? So, I'm like, wow.
You know? Right. Green Dolphin Street.
Yeah. But now the thing is, he could play all of that.
Oh,
he
showed
us. He said, "Yeah, man, I can play all of that." But he said, "Yeah, some saxophone players seem to think that if they're the ones that can play Don and Wee the fastest and everybody else, that makes them good." He says, when you go to see jazz bands, they all play the same songs, but they act like, "Yeah, but you ain't seen us play it." They say, "But they still playing the same songs."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "But with us, we play the same songs in the form of a melody, but once we leave the melody, the rest of the meat of it, you know, is different every night. So we get a chance to, like, improve on what we're playing every night. Other bands, they got to play the same bridge at the same time, take a solo off the same changes, you know, 12 years later, the same songs, the same
mm-hmm.
changes,
mm-hmm.
you know, taking a solo." He says, "How different can you be?" He says, "With us, every night after the melody, you know, the way our bridge, better and better, that makes us explore more and more of this harmonic thing." So I'm just saying, Ken, this conversation, because of harmonics and Ornette, can be endless.
Yeah.
You know, it will never get to the end. You would just have to decide when you want to stop.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
And, it just, like I said, we can do this for 6 more months and still never get to the end. Yeah. In olden days, we had like a 32 set of Encyclopedia Britannica.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, well, we can get to 32 volumes of this and still not be finished.
Gotcha.
You know, so, and it's supposed to be that way because harmonized, you know, like Ornette never said, "This is the end, you know, there's no more harmonized, there's no more music, we got to the," like, come on, will anybody ever get to the last number?
Mm-hmm.
We just ran out of names. It's like, we got a billion, we got a zillion, we got a quadzillion, you know, quadrillion, you know, it's like, but still there are more numbers than that.
Yep.
You know, so, never run out, man, you know, of harmonics, you never run out of music, and so...
The way you're describing jazz, and really this would apply to any music, classical music or country music, it almost... Not to take anything away from anything anybody does, but it almost has an assembly line quality. You know, in other words, okay, you're going to put this piece in, you're going to do, and it's all planned out. I remember once Ornette said to me, and I actually recorded this, he said, "I don't plan it out and then play it." I don't plan something and then play it. So that, and my understanding, and help me with this if I'm wrong, is that you guys were in the act, you're in the act of creation at all times. Once you played the melody, you were in the creative act. You weren't in the memory act or the repeat by the paint by numbers act. You were creating something.
The best way, yeah, I agree with you with that. And also, think of it, you know, like, what do you do with your college education? And to keep the math simple, you know, let's say there's 15 people, you know, like in every one of your college classes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all 15 of y'all are getting the same information from the same teacher, but all 15 of y'all are going to use that information different once you graduate school.
Yeah.
You know, so the answer to your question is, how do you use your intellect, you know, before the intellect that you had, your intelligence that you had before you went to college? People are smart before they even go to school. Right. If you have kids, they're smart before they go to kindergarten. You know, there's a certain intelligence that we have before we even start school. You know, otherwise we wouldn't be able to learn. You know, school intelligence don't start when you first go to school in kindergarten or preschool. It starts when you're first born. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you don't get that, you know, the intelligence when you're first born, then that's when you really grow up to be stupid. And you know, and you don't know nothing. You know, mm-hmm. you have a hard time in first grade learning 1 and 1 is 2. Mm-hmm. You know, so let's get beyond that. We're not talking about those people. We're mm-hmm. talking about the people that, you know. You have intelligence, you know, before you go to college. So after you learn said subject in college and college is all done, people just use their intelligence to apply. Like, for instance, I know for a fact when I put my own group together, Matrix 1238, you know, from previous experience of playing in other bands, you know, not necessarily Ornette, but it happened there too, but in all other bands, you know, people always ask you, you can have a rock band and people still will come up to you and ask you, what do you call your music?
Right, right.
Can you come to a rock concert, you know, or, you know, it could be a jazz band and they play all of this jazz and still people come up to you and, you know, say, well, what do you call your music? You know, it's like, but didn't you pay a ticket for a jazz concert? I mean, so I knew that was going to happen. So I came up with something that's final, that when people ask me that, I got an answer for them that, like, totally shuts them up, shut them down, and make them walk away thinking, you know. And my answer is the raw, raw deal of exactly when they say, what do you call your music? I call my music a fact, capital F period, capital A period, capital C period, capital T period. Mm. And so those are call letters. It's like, okay, well, what does F-A-C-T stand for? I call my music a fact, a focus application of a concept built around time. Mm. That's exactly what music is. You know, for me, you have to be focused when you go to any school to learn anything. I don't care if it's podiatry, cat material. When you come out of that school, you have to know how to apply what you have learned. If you come up with your own personal concept, that's going to make you a different cat veterinarian than the other people who studied cat veterinarian mm-hmm. in class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in this case, my case, the T stands for time because music is built around time. All right, what's the time, man? It's like right here, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. You know, mm-hmm. that's the time. Mm-hmm. So I told the truth. What do I call my music? It's a fact because it exists. It's real, and that's what facts are. Anything that you can prove that exists is a fact. It's real. So first of all, it's real. You know, and it stands for we have to be focused. We have to apply what we learned from being focused to learn music. You know, we have to have a concept so that we sound different than you know, like other bands. You know. And, you know, like our whole thing is built around time. So when I tell somebody that, that shuts them up, shut them down, and they walk away thinking like, oh my God, these guys are so technical. Because you really didn't think that I would sit down and think about what I do in that fashion. You thought I was going, well, we call our music, you know, the sounds of the galaxy, and, you know, we just, you know, like get the stars, the moon, you know, we get the aura. It's like bullshit.
Yeah.
You know, this is exactly, you know, like what it is, you know, and they go, oh, okay, you know, great, I like that, I like that. It's like, yeah, very intellectual, isn't it? You know, you thought I wouldn't have an answer, you thought it was going to be some bullshit. No, we're serious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're serious.
And that would really sum up Ornette's approach to what he was doing. He was very, very serious and committed to the life of music.
Yeah. Getting back to, yeah, man, I got a promise France I would do a performance. All right. We left. We went to France in October. Ornette gets to a place like anywhere from 3 to 4 days to maybe a week ahead of time. So, and it's a good move because the reason why he does that is because he wants his body to be totally in sync with the new time zone. You know, there's a 6-hour time difference in France and, you know,
yep.
you know, the 3-hour time difference in L.A. Well, we don't have to get there like 2 days before to adjust to that, you know. We're still, you know, pretty close in our same time zone. But anything overseas, we would get there a few days early, you know, and we wouldn't get there the same day and have to, you know, like do a gig the next day. He wanted all the musicians to be, you know, like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed.
Okay.
You know, so we would get there. So my point is, we got there, and about a week after we got there, that's when we did the performance. And after that, we had no more performances, and Ornette found the place, and we started rehearsing. And I think our performance was actually like on the 18th, somewhere like that, of October, because we did get there like a week ahead of time, right? So he found a place to rehearse, and we was like, well, me and Jamal, you know, we weren't in a hurry, but we was like, well, wow, man, this guy must got money. The gig is over with, and he still got his hair paying for hotels and stuff, and, you know, giving us per diem and chance to rehearse. We could do this in New York, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when it got to be around the 28th of October, and long after the gig, we had rehearsal, and Ornette says, does anybody have to go back to America for anything? And me and Jamal just said, well, not really. We just told everybody in Philly that we would be back at the end of October, so we got everybody in Philly on 30 days, you know, like, watch my house for 30 days, water my plant for 30 days, feed my dog for 30 days. You know? I said, but otherwise than that, no, we don't have any real reason to go back, you know. So he says, okay, good. He says, because other promoters in Germany and Italy, you know, they found out that I'm here and that they don't have to pay airfare to get us over here because somebody else did that, but they will pay airfare to get us from France to Germany and this and that. It's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
He says, they found that I'm here, the phone has been ringing, and we got gigs. Well, I was, before we left, America was jumping up and down and talking about, whoa, this, the last half of 1975, 1976 is coming in, the bicentennial. It's like, oh, they created a new word, the bicentennial. Don't miss it, the bicentennial 1976. I couldn't wait. Well, Ornette got us over there in Europe in October. I didn't get home. That was 1975. I didn't get back to America until March of 1976. The bicentennial was like 3 months old. I was like, oh, my God, I missed it. So I'm just saying, yeah, October, November, December, January, February, March. When we went over there, it was the fall. We spent the winter over there. Burns had his birthday over there. We spent Christmas in Florence, you know, together as a group. We became family, you know, after 6 months. We was there till the spring. We saw grass coming up after 6 months. You can say we was almost a resident of France. We knew our way around, you know, the certain streets, certain stores. We knew where the park was. You know, we would just go there and chill because we didn't know anybody there.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just saying, man, it was like, this guy was like just fantastic. And then after that, 21 times a year from 1975 to I think somewhere like 1989, Ornette had me on a jumbo jet going everywhere you can think of on both sides of the Pacific and Atlantic Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I really looked at it as a job. I never looked at it as a gig. I never looked at it as, you know, it's like, you got to, you know, you're like, you play guitar for Ornette Coleman. It's like, no. I mean, well, technically, yeah, but it's a job. I mean, he wasn't a slave driver. I chose to take it as a job. Then I would take it, you know, the whole thing with a different mindset. And it became very important that I do my job and that I do a good job. I mean, yeah, me and Ornette, we laughed. We joked about a lot of things, but when it came down to the music, I was all ears. Every word that came out of his mouth, I was interested in hearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you know, I made it my job, you know, like to do just that and to try to do this harmonic thing beyond the best, you know, like of my ability and what I could think, because it's not something that you get comfortable with. Like, okay, I know it now. I could just, like, if you know it now, then I feel sorry for you. That means you're going to stop learning because you think you know it. So you're not going to branch out. Captain Picard, once they found one galaxy, they didn't go, okay, that's the end of it. We found the big galaxy. They went on to find other stuff. You never stop. You know, so Yeah, man, I just wanted to, say how he jacked us up. He got to in October, but we didn't get back home for 6 months later.
Oh.
I mean, we come dragging back to America in 1976, and we left in 75.
Wow.
And that was my first time out to shoot, too, playing with a professional person. You know, it was always locally here in Philly. I played in a group. We played at the Uptown, which was a very prestigious place to play because all the Motown acts, big-time stars, played at that theater.
Mm-hmm,
Otis Redding, Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, Diana Ross, Gladys Knight, and I could just keep going down the list, I was fortunate enough to get in a R&B group in my early stages. I think I was like 16, 17, we played at the theater, which is within walking distance from my home, like the way some people don't live too far from the Apollo.
Uh-huh.
I live within walking distance of the Uptown. It's like New York had the Apollo, and we played there one time, and Philly has got the Uptown Theater, Washington has the Howard Theater, and these is where the acts, our R&B acts would go and perform. He was the first, prestigious. And I really didn't know all of who he was even when I, started playing with him full time. It was many years before I really, because he's not a bragger. He's not a egotistical person. He was very much a humanitarian, and he only cared about what we did naturally. What we discovered, he was always interested in, did you find anything? I mean, he wasn't like down our neck, did you find anything today? What did you find today? What did you learn today? If we would come to him, Arnette, I found this, he would throw his food away and go, yeah, man, yeah, what is it? Like, and then he would freak, and we would be like excited, that he would get excited over something that we found in Harmalize. Because we're thinking, you're the inventor. How can you get excited over stuff we do when the stuff you do is so far past us? But he was excited, because we found something, and he would see and say, man, good, yeah. Now, if you take that and you do this to it, and I was like, oh, my gosh, he would do that. Now I can get stuck on this forever. Like a Rubik's Cube, everything that he gave us had the qualities to be manipulated like a Rubik's Cube, and you would never get to the end of it.
Wow.
Yeah, so I'm saying, this conversation will never end for Harmalize. We can fill up 13 volumes of encyclopedia, like Britannica Encyclopedia, thick, chapters and chapters and pages, man. I mean, come on. I was with him for 14 years. You think we're going to do this in 2 or 3 hours,
right.
5 hours?
Right, or even 5 years.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get it.
I get it.
Can I ask a question about something? The first time I saw the band was, and I had sort of similar experience to you. I knew who he was, sort of. But I didn't really know much, and I had been working for his cousin, James Jordan.
Oh, yeah, Jordan, I love him, man.
Yeah, and Jordan mentioned to me, he said, Ornette's been trying to buy a building in Manhattan, and everybody's given the runaround. And I said, that's crazy, he's Ornette Coleman, I'll help him find a building. So it happened that fast, and next thing I know, Jordan puts me on the phone with Ornette, and, he says, okay, come on by, So I'm at the, on the Bowery, where the loft was on the Bowery, and I'm standing out in front, and I don't know what to expect, because I only knew his records, I didn't know what kind of a person he was. I expected this sort of, I always tell people, I expected a fire-breathing dragon. I expected this guy was going to be bigger than life, and, I may not be able to handle it, and this very, quiet, very kind gentleman walks up and says, hi, I'm Ornette, sticks out his hand, and I'll never forget, he had a cheesecake.
That's what I'm talking about. I was at his loft when he lived on top of the school building.
Yeah, on Rivington.
Yeah, Rivington.
Yeah.
Right? He was late one time. You know, when I got there, I rang the bell, nobody answered, you know, and I'm sitting on the steps, the school steps, for about 20 minutes. I'm just like, oh, don't tell me Ornette forgot or whatever. And I only had car fare one way, you know, to get there.
Right.
You know, and I didn't know anybody then. This was in the early stages. I didn't know anybody in New York. So it's like, I'm stranded. I can't. 20 minutes later, Ornette come flying around the corner as though he knew he was late. Like, oh, my God, you know, it's like Charlie's coming up from Philly and, you know, I'm late and I know Charlie's the wonder. So when he got there, I mean, I didn't question him, like, where were you? You know, but I was like, what happened, Ornette? He says, man, I was at a Funkadelic concert at Madison Square Garden. I was like, you were what? He said, yeah. I mean, he said it like he was a fan. He said, like, you know, like, yeah, the Funkadelic was playing. Like, he knew this group. Like, the history, like, he, you know, had a fan. Like, he had albums of theirs and followed them for years. Yeah. He said, yeah, the Funkadelic was playing at Madison Square Garden. And I went to, he went by himself. There was no DiNardo. Uh-huh. He didn't carry anybody with, and it wasn't somebody else's, because I'm thinking, it's like, oh, well, maybe it was somebody else's suggestion, and they said, well, now, come go with me.
Yeah.
It was him by himself.
Right, right.
You know, and I'm sure nobody in the audience recognized him, and he was there, not as a VIP. He was in the crowded audience with all the rest of the peons,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I was like, really? You were a Funkadelic? So, yeah, when you said, yeah, you met him, there he was doing, eating something as common as cheesecake.
Right. He was bringing...
And Jamal caught him eating sardines and peanut butter and saltine crackers. And he blushed when we caught him. You know, so I'm just saying, Ornette was so down to earth, you know, yeah, you wouldn't believe it until you actually met him.
Yeah. So we went upstairs, and you guys were up there already, because it was a break. I think it was a break, and he went out to get cheesecake for everybody. And he cut up the cheesecake, and everybody had a piece. And then you started rehearsing. Mm-hmm. And he was what a host. He took a folding chair out, he put it right down the middle of the loft, he sat me down, and he let me watch. It was, you know, one of the highlights of my musical experience. And but you guys didn't talk. Like, you just played and played. It just went on.
Well, see,
yeah.
If you're talking about the Browery, that was a few years later.
Mm.
You know, and the reason why we didn't talk, because when he lived on Prince Street, you know, and he stayed a few years there, and that was orientation there, Ken. So by the time you saw us at the Bowery, we had already finished first grade and second grade of, you know, like, Homiladic. So it really wasn't into, we kind of knew, you know, how to get started at that point. That's why there was little talking, and he could just say, okay, here's the music, and he counted off, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, and bam, we just, you know, and he would say that. It's like, I count 1, 2, 3, 4, and I want bam. You know, like, go ahead. He says, usually the deal is musicians are taught, work your way up to intensity. You know, like, start off soft and just get more intense as you go along. He says, no. He says, I want us to sound like a TV program already in progress.
Wow.
You know, so it's like, don't work your way up. Start there and go from there on. And we're like, wow, cool, dude. You don't know what you're getting ready to get. Bring it. Man, Ornette loved us, man.
I loved it.
He got some of what he wanted. He wanted to get kicked in his ass. We kicked his ass.
I bet,
not literally, but I'm just saying, there were points where we kicked his ass and we didn't know it, and he came to us, and it was stuff like this. It's like, he didn't come and say, y'all kick my ass. What he would say was, at the end of the night, we're back at the hotel, and he would gather us up together and says, man, you guys played so beautiful tonight. And we're like, we did? We thought last night we played, but he said, tonight, what you guys did, he says, each one of y'all seems like y'all found your own home, you know, and it all, like, people who live harmoniously on the same row home block,
houses.
He said, that's what y'all did. He said, it was so beautiful, man. He says, I almost cried. He says, I'm going to treat all of y'all to dinner tonight, whatever you want.
Nice.
So,
nice.
You know, there were times, like, we did do exactly, you know, what he wanted us to do, and he would let us know. You know, and there was one time, I guess I played so horrible, he told me, he said, Charlie, you sound like an explosion in a hardware store. Okay. Ultimate of insults. You know what's in a hardware store, man? Metal, nails, tools. So and imagine an explosion. Those different tones are clashing. Nails and screws, you know, and saws and crowbars and, you know, everything metal you can think of. I was like, thanks, Annette. You know, so, but the overall, you know, it's like, if you took anything that he said personal, then, you know, he shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. I mean, when he said that, he wasn't trying to insult me, mm-hmm. you know, and I didn't feel insulted, you know, it was just, and he was expressing the intensity, you know, I mean, and he said, well, you know, the good part about it is, Charlie, maybe you didn't do the music as well as I knew you could do that night, but the best quality that you had there was intensity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's always something, you know, and music, you know, and I learned in that case there, you just, you know, you need intensity. You need notes. You need, you know, like intelligence. You need a concept, you know, and you need intensity, you know. I mean, you know, you need that. You know, you just don't just play all, like, tiptoeing through the tulips and all dainty, you know, and stuff like that. It's like, you need that. You know, you need to be delicate at times, and you need to, even when you're delicate, you need, as delicate as tulips are, you need to be intense when you dig in that dirt. You just like, okay, dirt, can you, I'm going to just get a little whisk broom and whisk the dirt, you know. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you got to dig that dirt. That's intensity right there for something as delicate as a tulip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm saying, Ken, once again, this can go on, you know, I mean, we could be on the phone, and the next thing you go, what time is it? It's like, oh, it's December the 2nd, 3:30 in the afternoon. It's like, oh, my God, we've been on the phone since August, you know? So, well, you know, I'm just saying, this can, like I said, 14 years of training cannot be explained, you know.
No, of course, but we...
I'll put it this way. Each question that you ask me has more than five chapters of an answer, a legitimate answer, you know, that is very interesting, you know, and detailed, you know, and like I said, man, I am like so, I don't know what to say, man. A chill goes up and down my back if I could have, you know, think about the many different ways I could have missed this.
Mm.
You know, if my parents had moved one block over instead of on this block, mm-hmm. you know, it would have altered everything, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe, you know, growing up as a child, if I didn't get sick and stayed out of school for a week, you know, because I had, you know, I had to whoop and cough or whatever as a kid, you know, you get these kid ailments. Maybe, you know, something would have went on that week in school that would have changed my whole mind about what I wanted to do.
Yep.
You know, let's say at the time I was supposed to meet Jamal, you know, I spent extra time at a supermarket and missed meeting Jamal by 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So thing, I mean, there's a lot of things that I can think of where I would have missed this. And it scares me, really, to think what kind of musician I would be today if I had never met Ornette.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is like my worst nightmare, you know. It's like what I would become a musician I might be if I never met him.
Mm.
You know, so I mean, believe me, man, that is very scary.
You know, I have that same feeling about what kind of human being I'd be, because I met him when I was 20.
Okay.
And I was a little uncivilized, you know. I was a little savage, a bit, you know. I wasn't very well brought up, you know. And he, you know, I worked for him for about 6 months on that Rivington building. You know, there was a lot going on there, and so we'd see each other almost every day. And
oh, you were responsible for him getting the school built.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay, Ken, yeah, all right. I remember you hanging around.
Yeah, right. I was just this mysterious guy hanging around. What's he doing here, you know?
Yeah. Well, I wasn't like, what you doing?
Well, here, I mean,
you
know? I would ask.
I just looked at you as like, I knew Ornette was into music, but I also know that life involves more than music, that Ornette needed a place to stay, so he had people of real estate around him.
Yep.
You know, he needed lawyers for you know, like to be able to stay in certain buildings because they would get petitions to put him out.
I know.
We can't take the saxophone noise and this and that. So Ornette needed a lot of lawyers. So I knew he had, you know, I've seen a lot of people that had no involvement in music at all, and I knew that they were just as close to him as what we were, you know, for what it was that, you know, he needed to keep his musical life and his domestic life together.
And he wanted wanted to proceed with the finding of the building and the acquisition of the building and the dealing with I don't know if you remember, there was a lady that had a school on the ground floor.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, there was a lot of moving pieces, and he was tutoring me that we had to do it harmonically. Like, I had this sort of, you know, bulldozer mentality. We're just going
to
go.
Now, wait a minute. That is so interesting. I'm sorry to cut you off.
Yeah.
But this is a good point. It goes to show you that harmonies can also be applied to other things besides music.
Yes.
Now, how many other musical concepts from other band leaders can do that?
And I never even heard of it, but the idea that you
there
can
you
do
go.
That. Yeah.
Right. Only harmonies, man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, oh, man, this is so great.
Yeah. So when you say, you know, what kind of musician would I be had I not met him? I mean, to this day, I think, what kind of human being would I be?
Yeah.
I would have missed some really important lessons. I can't necessarily articulate to the last degree what every lesson was, but I know that I draw on them all the time. I use them all the time, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
So, well, this is great. You know, we're on a Skype line, so Skype is very shaky sometimes, and I keep looking at the clock thinking, oh, please, Skype, don't break down on us now, you know? So we've been lucky, and maybe, as you say...
You could have Skyped me on my Skype. I have Skype.
Yeah, but I can't record...
It's the world.
Yeah. We won't aggravate ourselves by talking about the world of technology. But this was beautiful. This was what I hoped. I know we can't cover it all, but I want to give people who are curious about Ornette or know his music and love it just some feeling, some flavor of what was going on behind the scenes, what was going on in the creation of the music. And we did it. You did it. So I thank you. And for people that want to follow you and see what you're doing now, you mentioned the name of your band earlier. Can you say it again?
Yeah, it's Matrix 1238, like the time. Like, what time is it?
Okay.
You know, so I say, oh, it's 1238.
Okay. Okay. And of course, you're based in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And people can find you on the web, or if...
They can just email me.
Okay.
You know, I don't have a website.
You okay if I put your email address underneath this interview?
Sure.
Okay, if anybody's listening and has never heard Primetime, you're in for a world of discovery. And I have to say, when you guys played for the recessional, my heart, it was so full of joy. It was like the proof that Ornette and what was in his mind and in his heart lived on when you guys were playing. It was that proved it. And it was,
I know what you're saying.
Yeah, so it was a beautiful way for that memorial to end. So Charlie Ellerbe, thank you so much for this time. I really appreciate it, and we will be in touch about other stuff soon. I hope someday.
One of the things I had to say in, you know, finalizing everything was, in most musical situations, you know, when it's all said and done, you know, like for instance, like say you played in Chick Corea's band, or you was in Patti LaBelle's band for years or whatever. Well, usually when a musician leaves a musical situation, the only thing they leave with is the experience of what it was that they actually experienced and did.
Uh-huh.
You know? So they actually kind of like leave with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
With Ornette, when it was all said and done, I left because he gave us a concept. Most bands, when it's over and you leave with nothing. You know, with just the experience of, I played, you know, like with Noel Pointer, or I played, you know, like with Grover Washington, you know. And, you know, you just learn their songs. And when you leave, you just leave and you just have experience. With Ornette, not only do I have the experience of what went down, you know, like once again, he left me with a gift that I keep on giving, which is harmonics. Most bands, you don't walk away with anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
So that in itself is something that musicians don't think about when they leave a band. It's like, well, okay, you spent 10 years with Patti or 10 years with Chick, or what did you leave with? It's like, huh? It's like, well, you know, what did you get after it was all over?
Yeah.
What do you mean? I wasn't supposed to get anything. It's like, oh my God. It's like, you see, Ken, when I say how blessed I am, you know, it's like, and, you know, like I said, it keeps on coming. And the more I think about things, you know, from this, I got more than music. You know, when I walked away from that situation, or when Ornette wanted to change and get, you know, like the next group of guys that he got, it wasn't over. It's like what I walked away from, I mean, what I got, you know, when I left that situation. Most times when a musician leaves a musical situation, you leave with nothing. It's just the experience, you know, of the traveling and the gigs that you did.
Yeah.
You know? So you don't need a, what I'm saying is you don't need a concept to play behind Patti LaBelle.
Right.
I'm not discrediting her. You don't need a concept to play behind Chick Corea, and I'm not discrediting that, you know. Ornette taught us a concept of how to play with him, you know. And we, you know, and he wanted us to add that concept to how we naturally play before we met him, you know. So, like I said, when I left that situation, I left with some valuable stuff, which is not the norm when a musician leaves a particular musical situation. So, with that, Ken, I'm going to go.
Okay.
And